I'm Micah Redding, and I'm here with Derek Webb. And Derek, for those of you who maybe aren't familiar with you or familiar with your work, how would you prefer to kind of explain who you are?
I'm a folk singer. I'm a blue-collar musician and an entrepreneur. That's probably about it.
Okay. All right.
So, like I either keep it simple or else that's going to be like a half hour's explanation.
Right. I got you. Well, so a lot of people would probably identify you as a Christian singer. Would you agree with that or disagree with that? Or
yeah, I tend to think that the word Christian, when applied to anything other than a human being, is a marketing term.
Sure.
And so, like, I don't really believe in Christian music. I don't believe in Christian art or Christian radio or Christian retail or Christian anything.
Yeah.
And like, so I have a belief system like anybody else does. I've got a way I look at the world like anybody else does, but the music I make is not Christian by any definition I've ever found satisfying. It's definitely not like redeemed music. It's not right or true or good or beautiful inherently. It's just the art that I make, and I'm like the same as anybody else.
Yeah.
I've got a way I look at the world, but that doesn't make me right. So, yeah, so I don't know. I tend to kind of shy away from categories like that.
Yeah. So you've had an interesting career, and, you know, I've followed it with a lot of interest, from very early on, Caedmon's Call and on through, kind of your Bob Dylan moment with, Stockholm Syndrome. because you kind of in that moment you went from kind of doing folk to doing things that were influenced by electronica and kind of changed a lot of things for a lot of your fans. Is that a good description, or am I kind of?
No, that's fair enough. I mean, what's interesting is I felt like all the records I had made from my first record up until Stockholm, which was, I think, 4 records. I mean, I kind of felt like each record was really different one to the next, you know?
Yeah.
And that kind of seemed to be, up until Stockholm came out, I felt like I kind of had a reputation for like never staying in one place stylistically for 2 records in a row. But Stockholm was so different than all of what had come before that it made all the records prior seem all very similar.
Yeah.
But before Stockholm came out, people, my friends anyway, kind of felt like I was just running down the road, you know, like not, because all those records, although they are like generally guitar based type music, mm-hmm. be it acoustic or electric guitar, they were all at least that. And,
yeah.
but they were all pretty different from each other in and of themselves. But then when Stockholm came out, it was just so different that I felt like maybe everything before kind of got lumped.
Yeah.
Which is fine because it did. I mean, it took a real turn. Stockholm and beyond started to take real turns.
Yeah. So yeah, and the kind of thing that led to this conversation, more recently you released, kind of two albums,
mm-hmm.
Sola Me as kind of a separate project, and then Control as your kind of most recent work. So maybe could you kind of explain what's going on there with those? What's new and different about those two pieces?
Yes, and I will try to do it as briefly as possible. because like I think what I've determined about myself is that deep down I'm a conceptual artist.
Mm-hmm.
Like I, contrary to what the market is kind of dictating currently, I don't write songs. I write albums. Like mm-hmm. I don't have a lot I'm interested in saying that I feel like I can say in a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. I like to take 30, 40 minutes to say something. So when I put a record out, and there's 10 songs on it, I'm not saying 10 things. I'm saying one thing. But I'm taking 10 songs to say it. And I've always done that. Every one of my records, if you zoom out and look at all the content, they're all about something. You know what I mean? And so the new record inevitably was going to be about something. And so I just say all that to say that it's a concept album, you know, but that's just what I do.
Yeah.
And apparently, and, although maybe I shouldn't be quoted as saying that, cause my record label tells me that concept albums don't sell well.
Right.
So I probably shouldn't really talk about it that way. But anyway, and so basically like the new project or projects, I mean, it was kind of a strange creative season because I felt like I had a lot of ground I wanted to cover. And what initially got me interested was, a collaborator that I work with quite a bit, a guy named Josh Moore, who has, been the other side of the production, with me on my last three records, and he's a total genius. And anyway, he always has something interesting he wants to talk to me about. He's always into some kind of cool, interesting things. He has a genius brain. And like years and years ago, I think when we were actually out touring on the Stockholm Syndrome tour, he was getting into and studying the singularity. He was reading Ray Kurzweil and some other guys and was just kind of like researching it and learning about it, and was just totally fascinating. And he would just talk my ear off about it. And so I started getting into it as well. And kind of, it was just this fascinating, what seemed to me like a mathematical inevitability, but with kind of some mysterious prophecy kind of living around it, in terms of, like, it feels like if Moore's law holds, it feels like a moment that we will eventually reach inevitably, but what will be possible on the other side of that moment is kind of what's debated and what's prophesied about by guys like Kurzweil and others.
Yeah.
And like the extent to which it's going to impact technology and culture and things like that. So, but I got really into it, and it was just really fascinating stuff. And and being a confessed technology addict, being one of these guys who lines up around the block to get the next piece of technology that I believe is going to help me to control my life and manage my relationships, et cetera.
Yeah.
I was especially interested in this moment where, you know, technology could potentially kind of take the upper hand. I mean, because like technology is so integrated into our lives, it's almost invisible at this point. And it's becoming increasingly kind of invisible. Like the more that technology can disappear, I think that kind of feels like the point. Like it's so inevitable, like an iPhone in your hand, or just kind of the always connectedness of the way the internet works now, where you're just, it's like you're always connected to it because of smartphones. It's like you at any moment have all of the collective knowledge of recorded history and all cultural memory in your back pocket at all times. And you're used to being able to just pull it up and be able to get an answer to your question. And make no mistake, it's a worldview. I mean, we stare through little screens, little glass windows into the world.
Yeah.
All of us, our children, everybody, we're all walking around looking and staring into little screens. And it's a way to look at the world. It contextualizes the world for us. It's a worldview. That's what it is. And right now it seems kind of fun and experimental and very kind of low stakes. But what studying the singularity kind of dawned on me that, you know, there's going to be a day coming here in the next so many years, depending on who you read, where the technology that we already know is exponentially becoming more sophisticated year after year. And it's also kind of in metaphorical ways with just the way that an iPhone in your hand starts to look like an appendage because it's just always there. You never put it down. But in very real ways, technology kind of disappears. It's just disappearing all around us. It's getting invisible. And with its disappearance, the on and off switch disappears. And so we're all, and just the way that we use the internet, our businesses, we can't live without it. And we can't live without our connectedness to all things. And so it started to kind of, as I was putting all this together, thinking about my own dependence and addiction to technology, I started to think, what would happen in some years from now when we can no longer say no to technology because it's so integrated into our way of life, when it suddenly kind of becomes capable of things we can't imagine, it makes me concerned. Like, I feel like we need to be thinking right now on this side of the singularity, whether or not it happens. I personally believe that it will. Now, what will come as a result of it is something that's more debatable. But
yeah,
like, I kind of wonder, like, this is the moment we need to be thinking about where we might, what role we wish technology to play in our lives, in our culture, in the lives of our families, in the lives of my children. This is a moment when we might be able to make meaningful decisions about where we might want to put guardrails around technology and not let technology in, where we might want to create sacred spaces in our lives where technology is not allowed. Because I feel like what I see is, in our pursuit of control and our pursuit of the efficient managing of our relationships, we have essentially kind of replaced a lot of our organic connection one to another with these unnecessary prosthetics with which to touch each other, like Facebook and iPhones and all the, just all these devices and technology and tech. I feel like we're, it seems fun now, and it seems like it's kind of meeting our needs in the you know, in the immediate future. But there's going to become a point where I'm afraid technology might really have the upper hand, and we're going to have given control over to something that will suddenly be infinitely more powerful than we could imagine. And this seems like the moment that we'll one day look back on and wonder when we could have made meaningful choices to have put those guardrails around the technology in our lives.
Yeah.
Because by the time we realize it, it's going to be too late. It's going to be so fully integrated, we won't even be able to find it anymore, let alone unhook from it. And so this is the moment I feel like we could have some real conversations about, you know, those roles. And so that was what I was wishing to make art about. And that's why I made these two records. That doesn't speak at all, I'm afraid, to the records themselves and what they're about and why I made two of them and the way they work together. But
yeah,
I think more importantly, that was like my concern and kind of what, that was kind of the, what lit the fuse in terms of me making these projects.
Yeah. So, on the kind of side of control, and maybe we'll talk about So La Mi in a minute. Mm-hmm. So control, kind of, I put them together in the playlist like you had recommended, and played through it. And there are a lot of poignant moments in there, and I think you've done a really good job at capturing that. That kind of disconnection that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I think there's a line, you say something like, I want to get back to where I didn't have everything. Something
like that. Isn't everything.
Yeah, there isn't everything. And so, like, a lot of that resonated with me pretty deeply, you know, like the kind of struggles that we have now are often struggles of excess. Like, we don't know what to do with our attention when there are millions of things we could pay attention to. We don't know, you know, how to have any meaning in a world where everything is available. Yeah. And as you pointed out, that's just an increasing problem. But I think that you know, a lot of people have kind of discussed that in an intellectual way, but you kind of have, you know, for me at least, put a kind of fine point on that emotionally, kind of seeing what that is and how that feels like. So I don't know. So that's what control is. Is that, am I picking up on the key element of it there, or are there other?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the line you quoted comes from a song whose chorus is, "I cannot feel because I feel everything."
Yeah.
You know, and so, yeah, and that's how it feels, you know. That's, and so basically, I mean, there's no better time to just kind of briefly go through. I mean, Control is, the album is based on a fictional narrative, a fictional short story that I wrote.
Yeah.
And based the album on that story. So the whole thing is told from the perspective of this character. And the character obviously represents me, and it represents us. It represents culture. It represents anyone who seeks to use technology to manage and control their lives. And basically the very, very broad view of the story is that it's about a man who desperately wants something that he can't have because what he wants is not real. And yet the journey he goes on pursuing it and the cost that he pays on that journey. More specifically, it's a story about a man who is obsessed with his fantasy life because when he's sleeping, he can kind of have everything he has ever wanted. He has control, he has confidence, he has love, he has friendship, he has everything he could possibly want, but it doesn't satisfy him because he constantly wakes up. And every time he wakes up, everything is taken from him. So in his subconscious, when he's sleeping, he can have all this, you know, this amazing, he can have the life that he wants, but he can't control it because it's subconscious and because he constantly wakes up from it. And he's like devastated every time the light comes through the window because everything, you know, that he builds in his dream life of the perfect life that he wants is torn down and he has to start again. And he goes from a sleepaholic to an insomniac because it's just too painful to live that way. And he reluctantly turns to technology to basically try to have or recreate or inhabit his fantasy life, but in a way that he can actually have and sustain and control. And I think that's an interesting metaphor for the way we use technology. I don't think people go by the billions to Facebook to manage their relationships because they all love technology.
Yeah,
I think they do it because they do it reluctantly because they're trying to manage and control their lives and their relationships. And places like Facebook make promises that you'll be able to do that. I mean, like that's kind of the promise of that tool. It's not the tool's fault any more than I would blame Ford or Edison for the tools they've made that we can't seem to use in moderation, that we use in excess and destroy our lives. It's not the fault of the people who fashion the tools. It's our fault of the fact that we have no self-control. So, but the point being, he turns reluctantly to technology to have these things. And there's this kind of, it's not sci-fi, it's not science fiction, because there's no science, there's no explanation for how he does it, but he does do it. It's magic. He somehow breaks through and fully immerses himself in the virtual world in a way that he's able to have what he has always wanted. But when he gets there, he realizes that it's much more powerful than he could have ever imagined. He cannot control it. And it's so overwhelming. I actually use the language of the prophets in the Bible who stand in God's presence and are overwhelmed and can't lift their heads and can't speak and can't move their bodies and feel like they're being crushed by the glory all around them because it's so amazing. And it actually destroys him. It's so good and so glorious that it completely destroys him. But as the story goes on control, he then equally mysteriously kind of wakes up and finds himself half hanging off his desk. You know, like he comes back, he survives somehow. And in his survival is grateful and committed, grateful for and committed to his real life and never ever wants to attempt this again. And kind of has this enduring perspective coming out of this terrifying near-death experience, realizing what he risked. And that's kind of supposed to be the moral of the story, but that doesn't really, you know, I don't really see just one ending possible for us as culture, as the character in that story. So that's why I felt as though I needed to provide a second ending for the story. Mm-hmm. That I felt like was maybe more realistic and unfortunately more likely, which is this story of Soul of Me, which if it's okay with you, I mean, I'll just go ahead and tell you because that's kind of where we're going anyway. But so Soul of Me was this separate record that I made. Soul of Me was the band's name. That was kind of the moniker we gave to the band. And it was essentially the same people. It was me and Josh Moore and this friend of ours, Latifa Phillips, who sings for this other band called Page CXVI. And really cool band. She's got a really cool voice. And we basically decided, let's write an alternate ending for the story of Control, which we had not, which was no one even knew anything about yet. This was like months and months ago, earlier this year. We decided, let's go ahead and create a shorter album that's a one-act story that tells the story of the singularity, that essentially tells the story of the first machine waking up. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a parallel story to the story we're going to tell in Control. Control is a story of a human, a man, who wants to cross over into the virtual world to fully control and manage his life, that to have everything he's ever wanted. He's trying to get through, right? He's trying to get on the other side of the screen. Well, let's tell a parallel story of the first machine waking up who wants the opposite. She knows and has everything from the moment she's born. It would be like Einstein coming out of a coma, not knowing who he is or how he knows everything. That's soul of me. It's like a baby being born with all of the collective knowledge and cultural memory of all recorded history, but not knowing who she is, what her name is, how she got there, how she knows everything, what she is. Like, and so we start to imagine what would happen if and when the first machine kind of wakes up, which is what the singularity talks about. What would her journey be? What would her questions be? What would she experience? And how do we think that would go? So we sought to tell that story in a one act kind of little narrative. Yeah. And it would be a parallel journey. They are both on two sides of a computer screen trying desperately to get where the other is, right? And so we wrote, we had Soul of Me all conceptually sorted out how we were going to do that album, and it was going to be three acts and how we're going to tell that story. And we decided Soul of Me was going to be this missing fourth act. It was going to be this little one-act story that told this alternate character's journey, and that they would eventually all go together to tell one story, but we were going to release it all out of sequence. So we would make the Soul of Me album, tell that story over six or seven songs, release it, and then immediately start working on Control, and months later put out that story, and then just give people time to figure it out and see if people could sort out how they connected. And so Soul of Me basically tells this story of the singularity, and the first machine that ever woke up names herself Soul of Me because the first three sounds that she hears are the three tones of the shape note scale, sol, la, mi, and she assumes that's her name. So she takes that as her name, accepts that, and then goes on this journey, immediately wanting to have volition. She wants to be able to make meaningful choices. She sees all these experiences of everybody ever, every video on YouTube, every moment ever recorded on Facebook. She sees it all and she can experience it kind of firsthand, but she can't affect the outcome. All she can do is play it over and over again and the outcome is the same. She has no meaningful will with which to make choices. And that's what she wants. She wants to be a disruption. She wants to disrupt the end of the stories that she sees and make her own real decisions. And that's what she does not have. That's what the machine would not have. So at the end of the Soul of Me story, as she's going on this journey to try to make meaningful choices, she too sees a way at the very end of her journey to come through and kind of break through her world into the real world. And when people heard the Soul of Me album, they had no idea what that moment could possibly mean or what it was. And what it is the moment where our character from Control connects himself, finds his way through into the virtual world. He makes that connection, right? But then he's destroyed when he gets there. But the connection lingers. So he is dead, but his connection, he's still like online, so to speak. Soul of Me sees that connection and she takes a leap of faith. And so in the Control story, if you listen to my album without Soul of Me, without knowing about it, when he comes back, it's not actually him who comes back. It's Soul of Me who comes back. She comes back inhabiting his body, and basically is able to have everything she wants. She comes back as this boy, as this man who, destroyed himself trying to have what she had and couldn't survive it. And so the warning at the end of the album is not saying, "Oh, I'm so grateful to be alive," and don't anybody ever try this because it's bad and it almost killed me. It's her saying, I don't ever want to be found out. I want no one to discover that this has happened. I'm trying to protect myself. And so, the last three songs on Control were written and crafted to work from both perspectives, to work both as the Control three-act story or the Control plus Soul of Me four-act story. And we crafted it literally. You take the Soul of Me album, those six songs, and you can literally in iTunes drop them in between songs seven and eight and they seamlessly go as one album. Even the production works. It seamlessly goes right in and out. And the lyrics were crafted. The last three songs of Control make much more sense from Solomi's perspective, which is the way they were meant to be taken. So essentially, the three-act Control story on its own is technically a comedy, because the protagonist is in a better place at the end than he was at the beginning. But you add Solomi in, and as a four-act story, it's a tragedy, because our protagonist dies. And this other character comes in at the end and takes over. I see either us coming to our senses in the nick of time, taking control of our lives back, and, you know, putting these guardrails around technology in time to actually have that be meaningful, or I see it already being too late, and I see technology having the upper hand, so it's like those are the two versions of the story I could see. And so I wanted to provide both endings. And so we crafted the second ending and released it before the album came out, and people didn't know what it was. And then we released the album, and people are now starting to put it together that it's two stories we're trying to tell.
Okay. So we've just heard the stories of Solomi and Control, Derek Webb's albums on the Singularity. Stay tuned for our next episode, where we're going to talk more with him about how humanity can have a healthy relationship with technology as we move forward. See you next time.